All right, John, the ninth chapter. We just kind of got started with this last time. Last time we had a Wednesday night study a couple of weeks ago. And Jesus, of course, he comes into contact with this man who was born blind. And we started last week to talk about how that the disciples of Christ really made a couple of mistakes with regard to their conclusion about this man. I think we had opportunity to talk about that a little bit. The first assumption that they made, you remember, was that all physical infirmities was due to personal sin. And we made the point that obviously that we know that we suffer physically because of sin. It's possible that sin, in other words, can lead directly to physical problems. Romans chapter 1. Paul talked about with homosexuality that they met the consequences of that in their bodies. That probably has to do with some kind of sexually transmitted disease. We know today we have AIDS and HIV and all of that. And you hear all of this business about, you don't hear as much, I guess, anymore. It's died down a little bit. But when it was really, people were really talking about AIDS and how many people were dying from it and all of this and that, and, you know, the solution to that problem is pretty simple, and that is don't sin. And basically, there are cases, of course, people had blood transfusions and that sort of thing, rare cases. But now, you know, they pretty much straightened out that situation. They're more careful with blood and that sort of thing. So, I won't ask for a raise of hands, but if I asked a raise of hands, how many people are just terrified that you're going to get AIDS? Well, you know, most people who basically stay away from illicit sexual activity and using needles and drugs and things, you really don't have to worry about that. And that's a result. So sin, that comes from sin. And there's other things. If someone spends his days or her days drinking, then you're probably going to have issues with your liver and things like that after a while. So the point of it is there are a lot of physical consequences to sin, but that's a long way from saying that all physical infirmities comes as a result of personal sin. That simply isn't true. But that was the thinking of the disciples. That was a very popular hypothesis back in the first century, and so they concluded that. And then, of course, because they believed that, then as they come across this blind man, they're thinking, all right, then, here's a serious physical infirmity, so someone sinned. It either had to be him or his parents, and so that's the question that they ask Jesus. And we recognize, of course, that they were wrong about that. I think I said last time that they were thinking it was an either or situation, but it wasn't. It wasn't either. We know you can't sin in your mother's womb. So this man who was born blind, he can't be the culprit, obviously. And then we know it wasn't because of something his parents did, because the truth is God doesn't punish people because of the sins of others. And that's why Calvinism is so wrong, because Calvinism is based on the whole idea that we are punished because of what Adam did. And that simply isn't true. One passage, of course, I don't know that we read it last time. I don't think we got to it, but Ezekiel chapter 18. And you remember beginning at verse 14, that's what this whole context is basically about. And beginning at verse 14, it says, and now suppose this man fathers a son, a man who is a sinner and involved in sinful things. Suppose that he fathers a son who sees all the sins that his father has done. He sees and does not do likewise. He does not eat upon the mountains or lift up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel. He does not defile his neighbor's wife. Does not oppress anyone, exact no pledge, commits no robbery, but gives bread to the hungry and covers the naked with a garment, withholds his hand from iniquity, takes no interest or profit, obeys my rules and walks in my statutes, he shall not die for his father's iniquity. he shall surely live. And as for his father, because he practices extortion and robbed his brother and did what was not good among his people, behold, he shall die for his iniquities. Yet you say, why should not the son suffer for the iniquities of his father when the son has done what is just and right and has been careful to observe all my statutes? He shall surely live. And then the summary of verse 20, of course, the soul who sins shall die. The son shall not suffer the iniquities of the father, nor the father suffer the iniquities of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself. And so there you have it. I mean, that's as clear as can be. And even as we read that, we think, well, you know, that makes sense. That's right. That's just, certainly. And again, that's what's so terrible about Calvinism, the idea of punishing. Now, we do, again, pay the consequences of perhaps our fathers or either even others, the consequences of other sins. You know, I mean, obviously there's suffering in the world sometimes due to people sinning. If someone goes into a movie theater and shoots a bunch of people, obviously some people have suffered the consequences of someone else's sin. But there's a difference between paying the consequences and being punished for someone else's sins. And so the Bible clearly teaches that we're not punished for the sins of others. So we know it's not this man born blind. It isn't because he sinned, because that's an impossibility. It's not God punishing him for his parents' sins, because, again, God doesn't do that. And so what is the situation then? Well, Jesus, basically, he starts off by telling them that they're wrong in their conclusion, that it wasn't because this man has sinned. Verse 3, Jesus said, it was not that this man sinned or his parents. So that's just Jesus letting them know, no, you've come to a wrong conclusion. You're not thinking logically. It's not this man being born sin isn't due to his sin or his parents' sin. Then he says something that is somewhat difficult to interpret, to understand. He says, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. So when you read that, it sounds as if on the surface that Jesus is saying the reason this man was born blind was simply so that the works of God could be displayed. In other words, God could be glorified by having this individual healed. Now, is that what Jesus is saying in this particular place? First of all, let me say that if it is, so be it. If that is what Jesus is saying, if Jesus is teaching in this particular place that God arranged, that he predestinated this man to be born blind, just so at the right time he could be healed and God would be glorified. Would God, if that's what Jesus is saying, would God have a right to do that? Absolutely. It seems amazing that he would, but he has the right to do that. That's what Romans 9 is all about, and many other passages. But you remember what Paul said in Romans 9? There's a lesson there, even if that is not what Jesus is saying. There's a lesson for all of us to keep in mind that at the end of the day, we're just the creation of God. He's the creator. And being the creator, he can do whatever he wants to with us. He has the right, and we don't have the right as mere creatures to tell God what to do. And basically, that's what Paul teaches here in Romans chapter 9. At verse 10, he says, and not only so, but also when Rebecca had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done nothing either good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of him who calls. She was told that the older will serve the younger. And the whole point of Paul, without getting too embedded into Romans chapter 9, The whole point of Paul in this context, remember, Paul was teaching a gospel that made salvation on the basis of faith, which means that it was open to Jew or Gentile. Whoever would believe in Jesus, have an obedient kind of faith, then that person would be saved. And it didn't matter if you were Jew or Gentile. Well, as that turned out in Paul's day, that would result in many Gentiles being saved because they believed in Jesus when they heard the gospel of Christ. And it resulted in the majority of Jews being lost. And the Jew, just listening to Paul preach his gospel, preach the gospel of Christ, and coming to the obvious conclusion, they would think, well, that's just wrong. There's no way. First of all, they didn't want to accept Gentiles into the fold, into being saved. But then to compound that in a doctrine that would result in the majority of Jews being lost, there's no way. There's no way that would be the case. So they were basically concluding either Paul's a false teacher and lying about this, or God isn't being fair and isn't keeping his promises. And so Paul's coming back and saying, listen, God can save whoever he wants to save in any way that he wants to save a person. And so that's why he begins to use the language that he does at verse 13, just continuing, as it is written, Jacob have I loved, and Esau I hated. What will we say then? Is there injustice on God's part? By no means. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. And the point of it is, even with Jacob and Esau, God made a decision based on his sovereignty that the older would serve the younger. That wasn't the way it was supposed to be, was it? That wasn't the way it usually was, but God made a choice, and that's the way it would be. Why? Because Jacob was better than Esau? That had nothing to do with their character. God just made a choice. He's sovereign. He can do that. He can have mercy on whoever he wants to have mercy. He can have compassion on whoever he wants to have compassion. He can withhold his mercy to whoever he wants to withhold his mercy from. Now, you know, the larger picture of all of that, we know as Bible students, and we understand what the New Testament teaches about salvation. Who is it that God's going to extend his mercy to? To who? Those who obeyed the gospel of Christ. And that was the plan, and that's what Paul was teaching. In other words, when Paul uses this language, oh, he can have mercy on whomever he wants. He's not going to do anything that's not right and not just, and he's not going to change his mind in mid-course and anything like that. We know who's going to be saved and who's going to be lost. Those who obey the gospel of Christ and live faithfully unto death, they're going to be saved because that's what God has decided. Those who reject the gospel, who turn away from Jesus, they're going to be lost. Now, does God have a right? Did he have a right to formulate that plan? Of course, because he's God. He can do what he wants to do, have mercy on whoever he wants to have mercy. And then he brings up, of course, in this context, Pharaoh and how God used him. He raised him up. And again, you remember, we all know about Pharaoh and what he did and how God dealt with him. Well, why didn't he, when Pharaoh wouldn't let God's people go, why didn't God just like that? I mean, did God have the power to put an end to all of that right away? Could have knocked him out with one punch, couldn't he? But he went 10 rounds with him. Why? He was demonstrating his power. And that's what Paul points out in this context. He was demonstrating his power for the world to see. And all of these years later, we're still talking about Pharaoh and the 10 plagues and all of that. He was demonstrating his power. Did God have a right to treat old poor Pharaoh like that? Of course he did. He can have mercy on whoever he wants to have mercy. He can show compassion or not show compassion. God is God. He has the sovereign right to do whatever he wants to do. And so that's what that's really what Paul's teaching in Romans chapter 9. And he goes on after he talks about Pharaoh, even down at verse 18, he says, so then he has mercy on whomever he wills and harden whomever he wills. You will say to me then, why does he find fault? For who can resist his will? But who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to the molder, why have you made me like this? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for dishonorable use? I mean, who's the potter and who's the clay in all of this? We're just clay, aren't we? And God's the potter. So the point of, and this is the point that Paul's making here. So go back over to John chapter 9 then. If it is the case that God predestined and that he predetermined that this man at a particular time was going to be born blind and then he would let him grow up blind all his life, and then when he was an adult at some age, he would have him healed all so that he could be glorified. If that's what God did, then that's what God did. I mean, he has the right to do that. Now, do I believe that's what God did? No. And the reason I don't believe that has nothing to do with it being an unfair thing for God to do. It just, my question would have to be, why? I mean, why would God do that? Why would it even be necessary? I mean, I understand with Pharaoh and even how he used Judas, of course, and all of that. Someone had to occupy those roles for him to be glorified in such a way. But why would God predestine an individual to be born, a specific individual to be born blind just so that he could be healed by his power and be glorified? There would always be blind people in the world. I mean, the world was filled with people who were blind or people who were crippled. Or God could at any time, and he did, arrange through Jesus, his son, and then later through the apostles, for people to be healed and so that he could be glorified. Why would he have to? And predestined an individual to be born at this particular time in a world that's filled with blind people already, just to heal him and be glorified. So when you stop and think about that, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Not that God would be unfair to do that, but why would he? Why would he just pick someone who was blind or a lot of other people were born blind or crippled? We've already run across one in John. So it really doesn't make sense that God predestined a specific individual to be born blind just so he could heal them and be glorified. But if that's what Jesus is saying, then so be it. Who are we to say otherwise? There's a lot of people who believe that what Jesus does in this context is he doesn't even address specifically why the man was born blind. But he sort of ignores that and just gets to the end result of it all. And that is that God, through Jesus, would be glorified. So he gives his answer, no, you're wrong in your conclusion. This man's not born blind, or this man didn't sin, rather, nor did his parents sin. But the end result will be that God will be glorified. There's another fellow by the name of William Tyndale, who was a reformer and a translator in the days of the Reformation. And he has an interesting take on this that makes a lot of sense to me. He believes that the end of verse 3 really belongs with verse 4. And in his commentary, he makes the point that most of us already know anyway. And that is that the verses in our English Bibles were, of course, inserted by man. And the chapter breaks and all of that. Most of you know that, right? I can't even remember the year or time. One of you might remember that. But at a particular time, man divided up these letters, just so that they would be more readable and make more sense to us. We could divide it better by having the verses in there. But in the original text, you realize they weren't there. And so he makes the point that the end of verse 3 really belongs to verse 4. So that he would be saying that the works of God might be displayed in him, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Some of your translations, the King James, has I instead of we. I must work the works of him who sent me. And I'm not 100% sure that that's the answer to this. Tyndale thinks it is. And when you stop and think about that, if you put the end of verse 3 with verse 4 and make that connection, it makes a whole lot of sense. In other words, Jesus would, the whole scenario would be, here the disciples saying, well, somebody sinned. It had to be either this man or it had to be his parents, because he's born blind, and that's because of personal sin. And Jesus just says, no, you're wrong about that. This man hasn't sinned, and his parents haven't sinned. And that's how he addresses that. And he just tells them, you're wrong about that. It's illogical to come to that conclusion. It's based on a faulty hypothesis. So he says, no, that's not right. The man hasn't sinned. His parents haven't sinned. And then he goes on to say, but so that the works of God are glorified, I must work the works of him that sent me. And he was about to demonstrate that. He says that right before he works the works of God and heals this individual for so that God is glorified. And so connecting the end of verse 3 with verse 4 does flow, and it makes a lot of sense. Tyndale might, that he may have the best solution to it. But one thing but again, I'm not going to lose any sleep. If you come to the conclusion, well, no, I think really God just predestined this man to be born blind so he can heal him at exactly the right time, you know, I'm not going to lose sleep over that. If God wanted to do that, he certainly had the divine right and sovereignty to do that. But I'm just not quite sure. I can't figure out in my own mind exactly why God would do that when it was totally unnecessary, when there were so many blind people or crippled people or anybody who needed healing at that time. And throughout all the miracles that we have of Christ, every time Christ performed a miracle, it had the same effect as it did when he healed this blind man. So anyway, you look at that and see what you think. But verse 4 is a homiletical verse that it's naturally broken down into practical points that really you could preach a 3-point sermon right here with verse 4. So let's take a look at the three things that just jump out at verse 4 that are very important. First, he says, we must work. We must work. And Jesus, in the immediate context, he's talking about the work that he's going to do with this blind man. But the principle and the application for all of us, we could certainly say, we must work. If there's one thing all of us should be sure of and make application of it to our lives, is the fact that as Christians, we have to be working. How many passages of Scripture emphasize the importance of working? Philippians 2 at verse 12, Paul said, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. We must work. We have to be busy. We can't just sit back and do nothing. We can't just let other people do the work. If you want to go to heaven, if you want to be pleasing to God, you have to be a participant in the will of God. He wants you to be a doer. And so we have to work. And then we're not talking about meritorious works. You remember that meritorious works, again, that just is another way of talking about perfect works, sinless living. Only way you can earn your way to heaven is to live without sin. You have to always have that in your mind. Anyone charges you or the church or Christians that well, you all believe in meritorious works. There is no sin. Really, the only meritorious work would be a total sinless life in which you never transgress the law of God ever. That's the only way you could earn your way to heaven. Once you sin one time, now you have to rely on the grace of God. Now the only way you can ever be saved is by faith in Jesus Christ. If you were to live totally without sin, you wouldn't need Jesus, would you? What did Jesus die on the cross for? For sinners. If you had no sin, if you never sinned, you'd never be separated from God, and you'd be heaven bound anyway. And that's the only way you can earn your way to heaven. So anytime people start talking about this business of meritorious work, they want to equate that with the idea of obedience. And whenever you say you have to do something in order to be saved, well, you believe in work salvation. You believe in meritorious. No. Well, we just believe in obedience. And over again, the Bible tells us we have to obey. Jesus became the author of eternal salvation to all them that obey him. I mean, over and over we read. I don't even know where to begin if I really wanted to look at all the passages that deal with works. What about Ephesians chapter 2 and at verse 10? Remember what Paul says there about works? He says, for we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus. Why? For good works. That's why you were created. That's why God created you anew, spiritually speaking, being a spiritual creature in Christ. The reason God arranged all of this was, first of all, to save you so that you can go to heaven. But he created you for good works, which he ordained, he said, that you not only just do one work and that's it, that you walk in them. That you walk in it constantly. We ought to be involved in the works of the Lord. And there's just passage after passage. Hebrews chapter 4 talks about the striving to enter into the rest. I think the King James says labor to enter into his rest. And I mean, we can just look at Titus chapter 2 at verse 14. Paul talks about being zealous for good works. And again, we wouldn't have time to talk about all of the passage. It's amazing to me that there's so many people in the religious world today who think, that just somehow you think that you can earn your way to heaven. No, but we must. Jesus said we must work. And we ought to understand, what is the passage that comes to mind when we talk about this sort of thing? Isn't it James chapter 2 that comes to mind first at verse 17, beginning, going all the way to the end of the chapter, really? But he says, so also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Ye believe that God is one, you do well. Even the devils believe and shudder. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? So the only kind of faith that really saves is a working faith. Now, we could read all of this, but again, you're very familiar with James chapter 2. But one of the things I often point out about James 2 is this. James didn't write this to expose some false teaching. Now, that's how we use it. Why? Because since the Reformation movement with Martin Luther and all those who follow him, they're the ones who started this business that we're saved by the finished work of Christ on the cross and all of this and that, and so that no work, no human efforts involved in salvation. Listen, that wouldn't even have dawned on the apostles. That somehow we could be saved apart from obedience. That we could be saved by doing nothing. That they wouldn't even thought about that. But the fact of the matter is, people were acting like that, even in the first century. So James didn't write this to expose a false teaching that didn't come for another 1,600 years. He wrote it to expose false living. Like, there were real Christians in James' day who were sitting back doing nothing. And so if you really want to get the importance of this passage, is let's learn to make sure we don't act like the people James was writing about in James chapter 2. People who are sitting back doing nothing. Because that Jesus said again, we must work. Christianity, as I've often said, not for lazy people. It's not for people who just want to watch. It's not for people who just want to talk. It's for people who want to work. And so Jesus said, we must work. But notice what he says after that. He didn't just say, we must work. He said, we must work the works of him. Who's the him? He's the one that sent Jesus, right? So we must work the works. There's a lot of people who are working in the religious world. The problem is they're not doing the works of God. Infant baptism is a work, but it's not a work of God, is it? The denominations are filled with people who are sincere and who are busy. Some people in denominational churches are working more than we do. Look at the Jehovah's Witnesses. You think they work? They work. They do a whole lot. They do almost naturally once they're ingrained in that, and they just do naturally what we have to beg and push and prod people to do. They're out working, but they're not doing the work of God. And so it's just not enough to work. We have to make sure that we're doing the right work and that we're doing it the right way. We have to hold on to the fact that we have to have authority for everything that we do. In fact, look over at 2 Timothy chapter 2. I recall what Paul says there about the race. At verse 5, he says, an athlete is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. That's important, isn't it? Someone involved in a race, that person can be the fastest runner that there is, but if he's going to get the prize at the end of that race, what does he have to do? He has to stay in what? He has to stay on course, or depending what kind of race, if it's a sprint or whatever, he has to stay in his lane, doesn't he? What happens if he steps out of his lane, even though he's 20 feet ahead of everybody else? He's disqualified. You have to stay in your lane. You have to compete according to the rules. And that's just Paul's way of saying, that's the way it is in Christ. We have to have authority for what we do. We have to run according to the rules of God. So it's not just working. It's not just being busy doing anything. We have to work the works of Him. And then the third part of that verse is, when is it that we have to work? What did he say? While it is day. It's just the third natural point in that verse. We have to work while it, in other words, don't procrastinate. And say, well, I'm going to, one of these days, I'm going to get busy and I'm going to start working more for the Lord. I'm going to become a more faithful member in the local church. No, we must work while it is day. Why? The night comes when no man can work. For Jesus, of course, the end of his personal ministry was right around the corner. He's just about, winter's just about to come. It's going to be the last winter he ever sees here on earth. And then he's going to be crucified. And he knows that the night is coming. But the truth is, the night's coming for all of us. We only have a little while to work. And so the time is now to get, if you're ever thinking right now, you know, I'm going to start doing more. I'm going to get busier in the kingdom of God. Well, don't just keep putting it off. We need to work while it is day, because whether the night comes because Christ comes back or because we die physically, or sometimes our night comes just because we lose the physical strength to do what it is that we can do right now. But the night is coming. So we have to work. We must work the works of Him while it is day before that night comes. Yeah, Paul. True. That's true. And it just, you know, and again, the Bible has never given us the impression from Old Testament to New that that's the way God views His creation. Just sit back and do nothing. Now, one more thing very quickly, and then the bell's about to ring. But at verse 5 then, he goes on to say, verse 5. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Now that's interesting only because, first of all, we know that Jesus is the light of the world. And we already covered that here, I think, in the last chapter. He made that same claim, which, of course, is true. He is the light of the world in so many different ways. But he's getting at something more than that. One way that he's the light of the world is by and through the works that he was doing. He was enlightening man, and he was showing the Father through and by the miracles that he was performing. And he's about to perform one of those miracles. So at verse 5 then, when he says, as long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. He wasn't just again claiming that he's the light of the world just to make that point. What he's really saying to them, I believe, when I read that, and in the context of this, is he's about to heal this man. And he knows it. And he knows people are standing by. What day do you think it is? It's the Sabbath day. And Jesus is basically saying, listen, he knows what his responsibility is, why he's here on earth, the work that the Father wants him to do. He's about to let that light shine. And he's letting them know that I don't care who's disturbed by it. I'm the light of the world. And he's about to demonstrate that. And I get to thinking about that. And that's exactly the attitude that we ought to have. We ought to be able to say the same thing. As long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. I'm not going to allow my light not to shine just because I'm worried about you or worried about what other people are going to think or who's going to be offended by what I say or how I live my life. As long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. And that's really what Jesus is saying. And again, he's about to let that shine by healing this man on the Sabbath again, no less. And so we'll get into that next Wednesday, and that is really what dominates the rest of the chapter. Jesus healing this man on the Sabbath, and how the Pharisees once again respond to that great miracle. And so we'll talk about that next week. Appreciate your attention.